Italian Wine Podcast. Cin Cin with Italian Wine People.
This podcast is brought to you by Native Grape Odyssey. Native Grape Odyssey is an educational project financed by the European Union to promote European wine in Canada, Japan, and Russia. Enjoy. It's from Europe.
Hello, this is the Italian Wine Podcast with me, Monty Walden. My guest today is Pierangelo Tomasi from the Tomasi family of wine estates. Welcome.
Grazie.
Okay, just give us a little bit of background about your family history and how you've come to have estates in all the major regions in Italy.
Well, I represent the fourth generation of the family along with eight other members. We're actually quite a large family. Everything started in 1902 when my great-grandfather Giacomo Tomasi started his own small winery in the Valpolicella area, so the northern part of Verona, which is where we were kind of born and raised. And generation after generation, the company has grown, expanding, acquiring more vineyards in the region. First of all, in the Valpolicella area to become a more, say, premium Amarone Valpolicella wine producers. And then later on, we also expanded acquiring vineyards in the rest of Verona, meaning Lake Garda and Soave.
Okay, just give us a bit more detail about the Veneto side. So you're making red wines, white wines, and sparkling wines there, I guess.
Correct, and rosé as well.
Okay, so what are your main denominations?
So the main denominations are Amarone, Amarone Classico, Ripasso, Valpolicella, I mean all the family of the Valpolicella wines. But then we also produce Lugana, which is our, say, most important and premium white wine project in Verona. And as of rosé, for instance, there is the Chiaretto di Bardolino from Lake Garda.
So those are three denominations that have had a lot of recent success. I mean, Garda is obviously an incredible tourist spot and attracts a lot of wealthy Germans from Munich driving down over the weekend. So prices for those wines are quite high, aren't they?
I believe they're, in a way, they're very good value, though.
The Lugana whites, yeah?
Well, Lugana has probably represented, I mean, the example of how a wine and a wine region, more in general, can gain from the visibility and the notoriety of the tourism. As you mentioned correctly, I mean, especially from southern Germany, lots of Germans have enjoyed spending their summer holidays by Lake Garda, though, and they've been drinking and enjoying drinking Lugana for years. And as a consequence, I mean, the German market is by far the biggest market for this appellation. The trend is growing. I mean, there is not only southern Germany now actually open to discover new wines and Lugana as such. So I see a bright future ahead.
Just remind us quickly what the main grape for the Lugana white is.
Well, it's actually called Turbiana. Turbiana is the indigenous clone, part of the more known Trebbiano family. So we can say that Turbiana is part of Trebbiano, but it's a specific one grown in the Lugana area.
Okay, you mentioned Chiaretto, mm-hmm. which for me is one of the most resurgent wines in Italy at the moment. What's changed for Chiaretto, which is, explain us what Chiaretto is and where you think it's going.
So Chiaretto is actually, say, Chiaretto di Bardolino, to be more precise. It's the rosé wine produced in the Bardolino DOC area, to point this on the map, southeast part of Lake Garda. It's produced primarily with three indigenous varietals, Corvina, Rondinella, and Molinara. And so red grapes, and the wine is actually vinified with the skins of very shortly, like just a little over one day. It's been existing for a long, long time. If I am actually totally correct, I believe that this has been the first Italian rosé wine to gain the DOC years ago. And generally speaking, we see a growing demand for rosé wines worldwide, and Chiaretto is actually one of them, an historic rosé wine that is now gaining a little more attention.
Is it gaining more attention because in terms of color it's been made a little bit lighter in color?
I believe this is part of it. We personally also change a little bit that in our vinification process. I mean, we used to make the Chiaretto a little more pink. Now it's much kind of more towards aromato. Chiaretto, correct. Copper.
Very pale
copper
pink, yeah.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
Did you change the blend then? Did you get rid of some grape varieties?
No. We've been making that with the same grapes as we used to do a long time ago. It's just a matter of a shorter, quicker skin maceration in order to get less color extractions from the skins.
And the complete contrast to that would be Amarone.
Yeah, exactly. Amarone is exactly the other way around. I mean,
sum up the success in Amarone in 5 words. No, I'm joking.
Oh, 5 words. I mean, if you tell me five pages, then I can do that. 5 words, difficult. Well, unique for sure.
So, what is Amarone first? Tell us what it is, and then and why it's so unique and why it's had such success.
So, certainly we can say we can tell about Amarone as one of the really top Italian red wines, no question about it. How do you make it? Well, first of all, where do you make it? From the Valpolicella area, using indigenous varietals in the blend. Corvina and Rondinella are the mandatory varietals. And what makes Amarone unique is the way you make it. You have to dry the grapes for, say, usually 90 to 100 days. We tend to do more 190. The longer you dry them, the more concentration you gain.
So you're picking the bunches by hand.
Correct.
And you're keeping them as intact bunches.
Voila.
And you're taking them inside.
You put them in smaller baskets on larger bamboo racks, mm-hmm. and you let them dry using natural air circulation. So you have to imagine big, we call them drying loft areas, where you really let the grapes dry for so long, getting the air circulation.
And when Pierangelo says drying, like the way he's explained about the drying, you can actually dry, not artificially, but you can have rooms that have air conditioning, right?
Yeah.
And you go for the natural way.
We go more for natural way. Let's say that the real main enemy to the drying process is humidity. So you have to get rid of the humidity. And when you have humidity, meaning if the weather outside is humid due to rain or fog, that's something you have to avoid. It's a time when you can possibly help yourself with some sort of dehumidifiers. But otherwise, the more natural you dry, the more you obtain what is your objective, which is actually dry. I mean, dry grapes, meaning concentrated juice with natural sugar.
So basically, the water in the grapes evaporates, and then that makes the sugar more concentrated.
Correct. I mean, the goal is to lose 40 to 50% of weight, which is the amount of water that has to evaporate.
What's your favorite meal with a bottle of Amarone?
Red meat, beef is definitely my favorite. I mean, the more you age Amarone, Amarone is one of those wines that can really age forever. All right, one quick step backwards. After the drying, you vinify, you age the wine minimum 3 years in barrels, and then you bottle. And then as soon as you release, the wine is supposed to be ready, but in the same time, you can say it's still young. The longer you age it in bottle, the longer you store it, the better it becomes. So to answer your question, when the Amarone is still among younger vintages, so to speak, I'd prefer with some beef. The older the Amarone is, it goes more with game.
Moving to another very famous red, Bruno di Montalcino. You have an estate in Montalcino. What's it called?
It's called Casizano.
Mm-hmm. Whereabouts is it in Montalcino?
So that is actually located in the southeast part of Montalcino, in just above Sant'Angelo in Colle.
Which is a little hilltop village.
In fact, Casizano is one of the highest elevation vineyards of the entire Montalcino denomination area.
What are you at, what, 550?
Almost 500 and something meters above sea level, yeah, quite high. We purchased Casizano in 2015. I was going to say the estate was founded in 1990 by the previous family, the previous owner. And then in 2015, we had the opportunity to achieve a goal, which is more, it was more like, well, it was a dream. I've been dreaming about purchasing an estate in Montalcino for a long time.
How big is the estate?
It's actually 22 hectares under vine. It's 53 hectares in total, including woods and olive trees. So 22 hectares under vines, 100% grown with Sangiovese of Brunello, Sangiovese Grosso grape.
So just this is one of the warmer regions of Montalcino, Sant'Angelo in Colle. But the fact that you're actually on top of the hill, I guess, makes it a little bit cooler.
Yeah, pretty much. In fact, I mean, there is one style in the Brunello that Casizano estate produces, which is actually, the elegance. Elegance is the key. We would never ever be able to produce a bigger, bolder Brunello where it's not that warm over there. So elegance is the key.
What about aging? Are you going for new barrels or are you going for classic
Botti? We work 100% with the traditional Botti, so Slavonian oak barrels only.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to impose my opinion, but if I was where you are, and I used to live in Sant'Angelo, I would be doing what you're doing. I think new oak would just it makes it too heavy?
Well, I believe so. I tell you, on the other end, we have never experimented a smaller barrel yet, but we won't, in a sense that it's not really the philosophy of our family. And this reminds me or brings me back to the Tomasi estate up in the Valpolicella area, where we work primarily with large Slavon oak. We have a few French oak barrels there as well for a couple of IGT wines, but when it comes to the real classics from the region, Amarone, Ripasso, Valpolicella Classico, etc., we only work with large Slavon oak.
A classic Brunello from Cassisano. What's your favorite food match? And you can't say beef for this one.
I can't say beef.
No.
Well, if I cannot say beef, then I would say cheese.
Really?
Yeah.
Cheese how? Like raw cheese or toasted cheese or
blue cheese?
Really?
Yeah. That's my, that's my favorite cheese in general, and I enjoy having Brunello. I mean, as you don't allow me to say beef anymore, because otherwise I would have said beef as well, or maybe wild boar perhaps.
Yeah.
So is wild boar allowed?
I'll have to just speak to our legal team about
all
that.
Right.
But in terms of blue cheese, which particular blue cheese, like a soft cheese, a runny cheese?
Soft cheese, I would say.
Oh, cool.
And again, I believe that depends on the vintage of the Brunello, though. I mean, the younger the Brunello is, maybe a kind of a softer type of cheese. I mean, the older, the more aged it is, maybe something a little more, a little stronger in flavors, perhaps.
Okay, next, let's go down south to Basilicata.
Yeah.
You have an estate there. What's it called?
So, in 2016, we decided to expand our projects down in the south, and we had the opportunity to buy a stake, the majority stake, in a very historic and well-established winery called Paternoster. Paternoster has been a family-owned winery since 1925, and again, just a couple of years ago, we had the opportunity to enter with two Paternoster family members as our partner, and one of them was actually Fabio Mecca Paternoster, is the enologist, still is the enologist of the estate. We're talking about really an icon in the region. I mean, one of the very first wineries that believed in the area. We're talking about the Vulture region, so northern Basilicata, at the feet of this quiet, silent volcano called Vulture.
So it's, if you saw the word in English, it would look like vulture, but they call it Vulture. Then it looks like a vulture without outstretched wings, doesn't it?
Yeah.
With seven peaks.
Yeah. It's quite high elevation as well. I usually explain this area as an unusual southern Italian region, if you will, in a sense that you're quite down south, but being so high in elevation and based on volcanic soil, the microclimate is quite different than, for instance, Apulia or Campania, which are only 2 hours east or west, but on a much lower altitude there.
So, I mean, what's the difference in picking dates for your, say, to Montalcino in Sant'Angelo in Colle and to Basilicata?
So, if you allow me to include also the Amarone as an example, mm-hmm. I mean, we usually start picking the grapes for Amarone in the middle or second half of September, and then, as we were saying, we dry them all the way through January, but the picking is made middle end of September at the latest, whereas we do Brunello starting somewhere like middle of October. The Aglianico is in the very end of October, sometimes early November as well. It's amazing.
You're so far south, and you would think everything would be picked like in the end of August, but it's one of the latest regions, isn't it, in Italy,
perhaps. Yeah. Is it. So, I mean, that's really very much part of the characteristic of this grape, Aglianico. And when we talk about Aglianico, we need to really be clear. This is Aglianico del Vulture, which is different than the Aglianico grape and wines produced in Apulia, for instance, or sometimes also in Campania. This is a specific clone that grows in that area, as we just said, I mean, high in elevation, northern part of Basilicata, which end up making a wine that is really full-bodied, but quite dry, rich in tannins, with a huge aging potential.
What's your favorite food match with that one?
You know what? To be honest, I don't think I've really found the perfect food match yet. I'm still kind of discovering. Yeah, I mean, I've been...
What didn't work then?
No, I don't say that there was something that didn't work. I believe that I have the opportunity so far to taste the younger vintage of Aglianico and older vintage of Aglianico. And I have to say that the really the more you age it, the better it becomes. becomes, which is in a way strange for me as a producer to say, because usually when you release a new vintage, you want the vintage to be ready
and sold.
And you want correct. But with the Aglianico del Vulture, you really need to wait.
What about with some of the cheeses, like the La Mucca Podolica, like those kind of cheeses? Can you explain what a Mucca Podolica is?
You can explain that probably more than me.
I'm not going to do it. Okay, it's the local kind of cow, and the cheese is ageable, and it's quite spicy. And I know Podolica is a cow that comes out the wrong end, yeah?
Correct.
So it's a cow that's born, I can't remember, it's either head first or... It's head first, isn't it? Normally cows have come out feet first. And so they, when they birth, the baby cow or calf comes out head first. Yeah?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. And
so we're actually going to do a veterinarian podcast as soon as we finish this one today.
Yeah.
And then we might move into aeronautics or other. Okay, so now let's stay in the south.
Yeah.
You mentioned Puglia just now. Tell us about your estate in Manduria. What's it called?
It's called Surani, actually Masseria Surani. And I have to say that this is the first project that we started in southern Italy. If I may go quickly back to the beginning, it was in 1997 when my generation stepped in and took over from our fathers that we decided to expand a wine project outside of Veneto. And therefore Apulia came in 2011. It came before Montalcino and Basilicata. And that was the time when we were thinking that southern Italian project would be a perfect fit for our wine portfolio overall. For a number of reasons, we thought that Puglia should be the region to go, and we're in Puglia in the area which we consider the heart of the Primitivo wine region, so Manduria. Manduria is the land of the first DOC that was created for the Primitivo di Manduria. So we purchased an existing estate, Masseria Surani, based on 55 hectares, primarily grown with the Primitivo grapes. And here we are, a few years later, I can say that it's been a fascinating project. We just mentioned the Aglianico del Vulture being picked and very, very late. We now talk about Primitivo di Manduria or Primitivo grape, which is one of the very first grapes that we pick towards the end of August, very early September. Though.
This is a very hot area, isn't it, Manduria?
Very hot area. You are very close to the sea. We're just about 10 kilometers from Ionic Sea. And so you can imagine the climate there is really hot.
It's fairly flat as well, isn't it?
Flat, pretty much. So,
but you must have a lot of old vines there, because it's quite a bit, in terms of diseases, it's quite hard for diseases to cause problems, right?
We still have a few hectares with the very historic so-called Alberello training system.
Which is a bush vine.
And then the majority, though, is actually with Guyot, which is part of, to be honest, of the project and the way that the previous owner of Masseria Surani, in a way, planted the entire estate.
And your final domain is what?
We have two more in the family. Yeah, we have what was actually our first project from 1997 in Maremma, in southern Tuscany, called Poggio al Tufo. We're now it's actually one brand with two estates, one in the very south of Tuscany, in the very south of Maremma, in such an amazing, beautiful city called Pitigliano. If you haven't been there, guys, please go, because it's an amazing experience and a Tuscan city. And then the other estate is slightly more northwest from Pitigliano in Scanzano.
So Scanzano sort of neighbors Montalcino.
It's closer to Montalcino than what Pitigliano is. Let's say that from the Maremma where we are at to Montalcino, time-wise, it would take you about, say, a couple of hours of a nice drive, in a sense that you enjoy a beautiful Tuscan landscape.
I agree. It is one of the most beautiful drives, and I agree about Pitigliano. So the differences between these two, you're making mainly white wine in Pitigliano and red in the Scanzano?
It's actually not the other way around. It is actually not the case, in a sense that you are right thinking that in Pitigliano you would make more white, but when we purchased the estate and the vineyards, which were 99% based on white grapes, we decided to replant them with more red grapes there, though. So we make more red wine than white. What do we do as white? Vermentino, which is one of the indigenous varietals from that part of Tuscany, and that's the only real white wine part of the Poggio al Tufo portfolio. And then we mainly work with red grapes such as Sangiovese, Cabernet Sauvignon, there is Alicante Boucher, There is a little bit of Petit Verdot as well that we use in blend.
So I imagine quite deeply colored reds then with Alicante and Petit Verdot.
Alicante in particular, we actually work with the Alicante Boucher, the sous-clone of Alicante, which has the not only the dark skin, but the dark juice as well.
In France, it's called a Tinterrier, which means a stainer, a red stainer, brings a red feel to the wine.
Which is usually used for in blends to give a bit more color extractions. We decided some years ago to produce a 100% Alicante Boucher wine. Interesting project. A wine that
it's quite brave to do that, isn't it?
In a way, I would say so.
Did it work?
It does work. It's not the easiest wine to sell, to be honest. I mean, I was going to say, this is really a wine that you have to find some ambassadors to believe in and really sell it to the market. When you produce a Sangiovese Cab blend or a 100% Cab, you produce wines that the average consumers worldwide understand and they can buy either at the retail level or in restaurants. When you produce an Alicante Boucher, you have to have real ambassadors, sommelier, so primarily on-trade, Horeca business, that are involved with this wine, they get in love with this wine and they believe it and then they take the chance to explain it and propose it to the clientele.
Do you think the white wines from Pitigliano will bounce back in terms of get more recognition? I mean, it's a historic wine. I know you. Yeah. I can understand why you say that. You know, it was a very hard sell for you, and you sort of switched the focus a bit to reds. But do you think there's a future for that wine?
Well, you know,
it's a beautiful place. It is a stunning place.
Well, I have to say, though, to be fair, that when we started the project in '97, it's not that we didn't believe in the Bianco di Pitigliano as such. We just wanted to have more red wines because it was our first project outside of Veneto and in Tuscany. When I mentioned Casisano a while ago,
being
in Montalcino Estate, being like a dream that became truth, this means that it was at the time when we bought Pitigliano that I was looking for something in Montalcino already. That was back in '97. Mm-hmm. We purchased Casisano in 2015. Quite many years later. So this means that for some reason we couldn't make that investment earlier. We decided to stay in Tuscany with our project, and here we are with Maremma, and therefore it was more red wines that we wanted and needed to have. It's not that we didn't believe in the white there, it's just that we needed more red wines in the portfolio. We still have Vermentino, we have a white, and we believe in the white. Is that area coming back when it comes to, you know, white wine success? It's hard to say. I cannot really say if it is going to happen or if it's not going to happen. I believe it will depend on how the region will open to wine entrepreneurs, like we did a long time ago. They can bring to the area a little more long-term projects, if you like, okay, vision and a clear objective of development.
So just one final word about Poggio al Tufo. What does Poggio al Tufo mean?
So starting from Tufo, I don't know if you can really correctly translate in tuff or tuff, but T-U-F-F, that is actually volcanic soil. Poggio is the typical Italian word used primarily in central Italy, so Tuscany and Umbria as well, as far as I know, that refers to these very beautiful rolling hills that are typically part of Tuscan area. So as we are with Poggio al Tufo Estate Vineyard up at 400 meters above sea level, and the entire landscape is based on these beautiful rolling hills, so-called Poggio, we decided to create the brand name combining the way the landscape looks like and the fact that that is based on volcanic soil.
Okay, let's go to the Oltrepò Pavese.
Oltrepò Pavese.
Where is it, first of all?
Southwest part of Lombardy, so approximately 1 hour southwest from Milano, not too far from Piemonte, in fact. It's another beautiful region up on hills, quite famous primarily for Pinot Nero, Pinot Noir grape. So it's an area historically known for sparkling wines, and again, primarily based on Pinot Nero. There is a bit of Chardonnay and other varietals there as well, but Pinot Nero is really, that is the land for that.
And what do you make? Are you making mainly sparkling or totally sparkling wines then?
We do actually produce there, so far what we have available are two, a white and a rosé Brut, both produced with Pinot Nero.
And is this traditional method or Charmat method?
That's actually Charmat method, but we bottled about a year ago, two Champagne Classico Metodo, Pinot Nero 100%, which will be released in 2021, so in 2 years from now. So we are going to grow our portfolio with both Charmat Method and Classico Method as well. And then we also produce a little bit of Moscato, which is another varietal quite well established in the area. Oltre Po, what does that mean? I mean, oltre, that means beyond, and Po is the longest river of Italy, and the area is just south of the river. That's why they say oltre, on the other side of the river Po. So on the southern side of the river Po, you would think that there is a river going across, so you would imagine the area to be flat. On the contrary, this is up on hills. Caseo, the winery that we own there, is actually up to more than 400 meters above sea level.
Okay, so your final estate is, you're saying, in Chianti Classico, where you have a stake in La Massa. So La Massa, where is La Massa in Chianti Classico? Which township? So
La Massa is actually located in the so-called Conca d'Oro, the Golden Shell, one of the hot spots in the Chianti Classico area, and more specifically in the little town called Panzano.
And Panzano is a little town within the wider commune of, my brain's gone, Greve in Chianti.
Greve in Chianti, correct.
And it is a hot spot, literally, in terms of climate and in terms of fame. I think it's a really up and coming historic area that's become very, very famous. I mean, you know, a company like you investing in Chianti Classico, you think if you're investing in Chianti Classico, that means that there is something about this region that is happening right now. Is that what you feel?
Yeah, I agree. Though, I mean, we decided to invest there, and I have to say that La Massa is not 100% Tomasi family project, though. We are in partnership with, we actually have two partners, and one of them is the founder and the owner of La Massa until we got this business set together, who's still the wine man in the business, in the company.
What's his name?
Gianpaolo Motta and his team. So we decided to consider this opportunity, A, to enter in an amazing small boutique brand. Secondly, to, in a way, sort of complete our Tuscan project, if I can say so. I mean, we started in Maremma a long time ago in Pitigliano. Then we grew the Maremma project with Scansano, as we mentioned, so all under the Poggio al Tufo estate brand name, and then Montalcino a few years ago. So Chianti Classico is certainly an area, as far as I can see, as a producer and as a wine consumer too, there is a quite intense comeback for the Chianti Classico wines worldwide, which is quite promising, I believe, for the area.
So you'd said that this looks like your last investment in Tuscany. So if I'm a Vino Nobile producer, that I'm about to retire, and I'm looking for a nice lad like you to come along and say, hey, Monte, I'll take your family winery off your hands and give you a nice price. Well, that's not going to happen in Vino Nobile.
You know what? I mean, never say never. I mean, you made an example of Vino Nobile now, so I just want to avoid any possible misunderstanding or gossip. We're not looking at any other further expansion in the area. But I mean, generally speaking, with us in the family, I mean, I can really say never say never. On the other end, we have plenty of projects coming up in some of these existing estates, some renovation to create some hospitality business as well, which is already part of our family. We have an hospitality business here in Verona with two hotels and a restaurant also. So we might do something in Montalcino and in Maremma as well. Actually, we already own an agriturismo by Poggio al Tufo. I have to say, though, that
Scoop coming up, everybody.
There is another project which was officially launched last year, October. So that's not really new, but we're kind of working hard to make it go its own way. And it's called De Buris. What is De Buris? That's the luxury brand, the luxury new project of my family, myself, located here in the Valpolicella area. So I can say that after traveling throughout Italy for a number of years with the Buddhists, we have kind of come back. The Buddhists is simply the name of a 1400 Venetian villa called the Buddhists in the heart of the Valpolicella Classico region, where there is a cellar with Slavon oak barrels, and where the wine produced, which is an Amarone Riserva, is actually, it spends its long time in aging. This wine is made in the most prestigious hillside vineyard that we own in the Classico Valpolicella region called La Groletta. Again, a project that started in our family, in our mind, back in 2000. And last year, October, so 18 years after the first day we thought about it, we were happy and able to launch the first vintage, which is a 2008.
Great. So I think we've done everything.
I hope so.
Yeah. I know you got to run. Thanks.
Happy to be with you. I was joking.
Yeah, no,
I would continue a lot more.
Yeah, if you do buy another estate, just I'll give you my number, my mobile before we leave.
You'll be one of the first people that I will inform.
So I want to say thanks to Pierangelo Tomasi, my guest today on the Italian Wine Podcast, for explaining the family history and all the estates associated with the Tomasi family. Very exciting range of wines. I mean, if I'm not a trade buyer, I mean, that's one of my weak points, as you probably know, anybody who listens to this podcast, about the commercial side. We've got a great lineup. You know, if you're like a football team, you say, yeah, you got all the bases covered.
Yeah, I agree. So.
So, okay, and if we do have a scoop, you got my email.
I have your email, I have your cell phone, I have your everything.
You can just put my GPS, right? You can just track me, put a little tracking device on me.
You will not escape away from us.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Pierangelo, and I hope you enjoy Vinitaly.
I will enjoy it. Thank you for having me with you. One last thing, though. Whoever is going to listen to this program, you are very warmly welcome to visit us anywhere in Italy, anywhere we are, to, in a way, touch with your hands that what we have explained so far is true, and we can really enjoy some good time together. So thank you very much for having me, and you have a good Vinitaly too, Monty.
Thanks very much, Pierangelo.
Bye-bye, everybody. Ciao. Grazie.
This podcast has been brought to you by Native Grape Odyssey, discovering the true essence of high-quality wine from Europe. Find out more on nativegrapeodyssey.eu. Enjoy. It's from Europe.
Follow Italian Wine Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.